Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is James McGreevy, who reads from and discusses his memoir, The Confession, published by Reagan Books. In the weeks to come, we have Sina Jeter-Nasland, T.A. Barron, Barack Obama, Richard Ford, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. James McGreevy earned degrees from Columbia, Georgetown, and Harvard before serving three terms as the mayor of Woodbridge, New Jersey. After a narrow defeat in 1997, he was elected as the 52nd governor of New Jersey in 2001, a position he held until his resignation in November of 2004. Jim's political career, however, is only one facet of his story, a story which he's come to share with us tonight. We're delighted that Jim McGreevy is at the Tattered Cover to present his memoir, The Confession. Would you please join me in making Jim feel welcome?
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here, and if you could all pray for lots of snow, so that means I could get grounded in Denver and I don't go to Seattle and the rest of this inane book tour. It's just a great pleasure to be here at this wonderful bookstore, and I just want to thank you for your hospitality, and I'd also like to recognize Lisa in the back, who's had the dubious pleasure. Lisa, could you please stand? Thank you. Lisa's had the dubious pleasure of carting me around all day long. She's the only woman I know who's perfectly accessorized to match the color and contour of her car. And she happens to have been raised in New Jersey, which I don't know of her judgment for permanently living in Denver, but she's always welcome home. What I'd like to do a little bit tonight is to have just a brief reading from sections of The Confession, and then just to open it up for a Q&A. And if I can. I was 11 years old when my parents sent me away to spend the summer before sixth grade at Boy Scout camp. This was my first chance to venture out of my all-Catholic universe, and I was both excited and a little scared. It was immediately clear that I was in over my head. The camp was filled with public school kids who were undisciplined and aggressively competitive compared to my St. Joseph's peers. They seemed almost feral. I hadn't realized until then how deeply the nuns had driven their fearful sense of order into our little minds. All day I tagged along behind the other kids my age, making myself helpful and cracking jokes, but it did me little good. The nuns had always put a premium on perseverance, so I kept at it as long as I could. At some point in the afternoon, though, I finally ran out of steam. I climbed into my sleeping bag early that night, when most of the kids were still shooting the bull around the campfire outside. Not a bad day on balance, I thought. Try again tomorrow. From my tent, though, I could still hear the guys talking. As soon as I was out of sight, they turned to mocking me, using words I'd never heard before, at least not about myself. Fag. Homo. He's a fag. We can tell he's a fag. He doesn't like girls. Queer. You can just tell he's a queer motherfucker. A faggot. I shook, then cried in my sleeping bag. Was I imagining things? I shook my head clear and lifted an ear into the air to take another reading, but the words were the same. Still, my disorientation was so thorough that I found myself questioning where they were coming from. Were they really calling me those names, or were those voices in my own mind? Try as I might, I couldn't be sure. As my mind raced on, I remember thinking that this could play out in one of two ways. If it wasn't a hallucination, I would have to find a way to prevent it from ever happening again. I would have to walk through life like a blind man, touching the walls around me and sniffing the air for clues, using multiple senses to get my bearings wherever everyone else got by with one. If what I heard was true, on the other hand, if those boys really were calling me a faggot, then I was in deeper trouble. Why? Because from where they were sitting, they must have known I could hear them. Their raised voices told me they were presenting me with a challenge. I could either go out and confront them and get my ass kicked for my trouble, or stay in the tent and sail my reputation as a sissy. Until this moment, I realized now I'd never put together the pieces of the puzzle of my own life. I can't even swear that I knew in the summer of 1968 exactly what a fag was. My only goal in camp had been to fit in, to win the respect of the other boys. I reviewed everything about how I had behaved that day to see where I went wrong. What could possibly have triggered their hatred? And then it came to me. In the morning, in one of my fits of eagerness to please, I'd seen another boy wrestling with his knapsack, and I'd stepped forward to help him take it off. It was an innocent gesture, the kind of thing that had been encouraged. Camp differently, apparently, was a different story. How stupid, I thought. Stay within the lines, Jim. Don't give them any more rope to hang you with. As I drifted off to sleep that night, I made my decision. I'd be one of the guys, be as strong and masculine as possible. And as soon as I get home from camp, I'd resolve I'd find a girl and kiss her. And the next morning, I threw back the screen of my pup tent, headed straight for the ringleader from the night before, and began a campaign to win him over. I was persistent. I kept him close, showed him that I could work harder, chop more wood, navigate the forest. Through sheer willpower, I turned him from a name-calling enemy into a good friend. He never knew what hit him. In sophomore year, I accompanied Sean to a neighborhood party. I don't recall whose family it was, but the house immediately became a warren of teenage debauchery. Beer cans popped open, marijuana joints were lit. Unlike my peers, I had no taste for alcohol. To this day, I don't smoke, don't drink more than a few sips of wine on special occasions, and I never smoked a cigarette or tried drugs of any sort. I suppose that makes me unique among my generation of politicians. But drugs never appealed to me. Sean was having a blast. Everyone was. Kids were making out everywhere, from the basement to the master bathroom upstairs, talking and laughing in small groups. But something about this party made me realize that I had nothing in common with them. Looking around me, I saw in their faces a simple joy that I felt would forever elude me. Without saying goodbye, I left the party to walk around the neighborhood, taking in the fresh air. As I began to cry in a way I hadn't before or since. By now I knew a little more about homosexuality, amazed to learn how fully it had been embraced by the ancient Greeks and Romans. I read Spartacus with its magnificent love scene between Antonio and Crassus. I also read Oscar Wilde and D.H. Lawrence and committed swaths of Brideshead Revisited to memory. I had heard of gay life in Greenwich Village just across the New York Harbor, invisible for the tops of buildings in Carteret. Still, in all my reading, I had never found evidence of two men falling in love simply, settling down, and pursuing a life together among their family and friends. And more to the point, I knew there was not another person at that party or in the rich landscape of Carteret whose life was anything like mine. For all I knew, I was the only gay kid in school, in my neighborhood, perhaps in the whole town. And the loneliness this realization gave me was insufferable. I'd felt totally let down by my faith. What did I do? I prayed to God. I've been good. I prayed. I tried to live a spiritual life. No relief came. Did you make me gay as a way to humble me? Where's the relief, God? How do I find the way? Nothing. In those moments of suffering, I admit I resented God. I felt the grip of evil, and I was angry at God for that. Theologically, I felt completely lost, totally without hope. And in a way that teenagers do, I came to the conclusion that my only reprieve would be suicide. I would not detail the intricacies of my thinking, except to say that I never found the courage even to do that. And thus, my self-esteem was further pummeled. How do you live with such shame? How do you accommodate your own disappointments, your own revulsion with who you've become? How do you get out of bed in the morning feeling as bad as I did? Or kiss your mother hello or say a prayer in church? when your self-respect has vanished. How can you carry on such an inauthentic life? You do it by splitting in two. You rescue at least part of yourself, the half that stands for tradition and values in America, the part that looks like the family you came from, the part that is, quote-unquote, acceptably true. And you walk away from the other half that you would abandon, something spoiled, something disgusting. This is a metaphorical amputation, because that other half doesn't stop existing. You just take less and less responsibility for it, until it seems to take on a life of its own, to become something you merely observe, something you alone can see. And when you're on the other side in the shrubbery or behind the synagogue, you no longer recognize your decent self. Years later, I realized I became both Gene and Phineas from a separate piece, the soul and the body, the person who tumbled from the tree and the person who made him fall. Dostoevsky defined man as a creature who can get used to anything. Yes, but not without consequences. On both sides of this divide, my behavior began to take on something like a dreamlike hue. But desire doesn't go away under this kind of pressure. It mutates. In my case, it went from the simple passions of a young adult for physical and romantic love and happiness to a particularly rank, unfulfilling variety of lust. I felt it get ranker and less fulfilling with each passing year. Every step down I took, the farther I knew I would have to climb back up. I craved the normal things about love. I wanted a kiss. I ached for a hug. I dreamed of sharing a life with someone I loved, some man I loved. I used to make long lists of guys I had crushes on, scribbling their names like teenagers. But I never allowed my conquest to be anything like that. As glorious and meaningful as it would have been to have a loving and sound sexual experience with another man, I knew I'd have to undo my happiness step by step as I began to chase my dream of a public career and the kind of acceptable life that went with it. So instead, I settled for the detached anonymity of bookstores and rest stops, a compromise, but one that was wholly unfulfilling and morally unsatisfactory. On Sunday, as previously arranged, we went to Boston. Dina, Jacqueline, and I shared a suite. Dina could tell I was distracted. I'm sure, but by then our relationship was so distant that the new tension in the air was entirely unmentioned. On Monday, I delivered my stem cell research at the National Democratic Convention. On the way back, Jamie and I released the state troopers and sat on a bench in Boston Common, watching a beautiful afternoon unfold. Children played and a pair of swans circled in the lake. I realized for the first time that I was filled with fear about my future, what it would mean to my family, my parents, and all that I'd known. I was overwhelmed with the sense that I had jeopardized everything I hold dear. But Jamie, my chief of staff, was a tremendous comfort. Without his constant friendship and love, I could never have survived what was to come. "You're strong enough to handle this," he told me. "People are either victims or survivors, and it may be painful, but you're going to be a survivor. You'll get through this." All of a sudden, I looked at my friend Jamie differently, not just as my chief of staff, but as a gay man. I imagined the life he lived when he wasn't in office, the adolescence he must have endured, one that was probably much like my own. The thought that Jamie had survived his own journey gave me strength. I read Frankl over and over again, finding words in this narrative of resilience to describe my own challenges and to give me hope. The lessons of Viktor Frankl are universal. We all fight against a hopelessness, a sense of our own imprisonment. Yes, I built the gates that contain me, wreathed them with barbed wire myself. I dreaded being ripped open by bullets from the sadists in the guard tower, where I was the only gunman, a construct of my own delirium. Mostly, I entered a conspiracy with a world that drove gay kids into a state of dualism. Part of the world, but apart from it. Unable to participate wholly. I hated this world. Every minute I saw what it did to me, how it twisted me against myself, how it exiled me even when I refused to leave. Frankl wrote, "Anything outside the barbed wire became remote, out of reach, and in a way unreal. The events and the prisoners outside, all normal life, had a ghostly aspect for the prisoner. The outside life, that is as much as he could see of it, appeared to him almost as it might have to a dead man who looked at it from another world. In the garden, on these formless days after my announcement, a normal life seemed further and further out of reach." My survivor's therapy group met for the first time in the morning. There were six of us. We met, sat in chairs arranged in a semicircle. Our group leader was Roxy, a no-nonsense and demanding therapist with a disturbing presentation. Her spiky hair was a half a dozen different colors, none of them natural. We'd been instructed to buy stuffed animals from the Meadows gift shop to symbolize our quote-unquote inner child. I didn't want to peer close to the therapeutic value of the program, but I thought it was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard. Reluctantly, I picked up Kermit. It reminded me of my daughter Jacqueline. Roxy gave us our first exercise. On large sheets of paper, we would begin an epistolary relationship with our inner child. Holding the pen in our left hand, we were able to write our adult selves using the voice of ourselves at about 7 years old. "Talk about the things you're scared of," Roxy said. "Talk about the things you need." "Dear Mr. McGreevy," I began. I felt foolish, but I pressed on. As I wrote in crooked cursive, I was surprised by the exercise seemed to tap into something. I wrote about the fears, the terrors my homosexuality had caused me. I never admitted this before, but I wrote about how I blamed God for making me different and all the suffering. My child told my adult about how he'd been an overachiever, to overcome the flawed character in his soul, to hide. "I'm ashamed," my left hand wrote. "I live in a state of shame." Layer by layer, the exercise peeled back my artifice. When I moved my pen to the right hand to compose a response, a powerful self-pity overcame me. It began to fall apart. "You're a good little boy, Jimmy. Being gay doesn't change that," I wrote back, words I'd always craved to hear. "Don't overcompensate." My last. My recovery may, as Ray said, take a lifetime on some days. I can only see the work ahead. For one thing, my memory remains blurry even after this period of self-inspection. Perhaps my forgetfulness is self-serving. I know I violated my own moral precepts in a way that I didn't want to remember. Or, as some gay friends have told me, repression takes its toll on memory. In any case, I think the cause is the same, shame. The compromises were too great. In order to keep going, I fractured. The work doesn't end there. I still have to complete a list of all those whom I've harmed and make amends to them directly. This is the most onerous part of recovery. From several people, I've already begged and received forgiveness. My parents and sisters, for example. Yet I have a ridiculously long list of people. I haven't found a way to tell how sorry I am. One of those is Golan. When I got out of the Meadows, I hired a researcher in Israel to locate a number for him, thinking I wanted to apologize for all the things that made him feel so inadequate and angry. I wanted to apologize for hiring him into my staff in the first place, which set into motion this long, torturous history. I wanted to know that he was all right and tell him I wished him no harm, but I haven't had the nerve to call him. Perhaps as I work the steps, I'll find the courage one day. Until then, I've become more authentic and integrated one day at a time. I reminded of the question Abba Moses, the ancient desert monk, posed. Can a man every day make a beginning of the good life? To which Abba Silvanus replied, if he be diligent, he can every day and every hour begin life anew. Thank you. Quiet, non-pressured reading on a Monday. Any questions? Oh, your iPod. Excuse me. This is a way to escape that. No. Sure. 25 years in politics. Occupational hazard. Click. It's what they call the grip and the grin. Ah. But you have a San Francisco hat on, which says something. We go to an Episcopalian church, and I just love so much about the Catholic Church, and I have friends of mine that are priests, some of which are gay, but I can't any longer sit in the pews and just... And the church isn't all just the hierarchy, but the official position on homosexuality and gay life is just so condemnatory. I just can't worship there. But there are many gay Catholics who do, and you know, my friend Andrew Sullivan, and I have great respect and dignity and different people, I mean, worship within the church, and I respect and admire them, but for me, it's not a healthy place to be. I don't want to wait another 2,000 years. Sure. Oh, whereabouts? Lisa's from Ridgewood High School. We have a minion. People have been wonderful. I mean, it just even, people have really been, you know, when I told my parents, I was just like, God, I wish I'd known it was going to be this easy 25 years ago. It's just like, it's people have been really affirming and loving. And so that's been tremendous. You know, what I see though around I was in Atlanta last week and just the pain in some of these young kids, I was sharing with Lisa, my heart ached. These kids that were, you know, 18, 20, 21, 22 years of age who've been thrown out of their homes, thrown out of their church. And, you know, it's interesting because my friend Mitchell Gold runs something called Faith in America. And it's all focused on religious-based discrimination. And, you know, you're in somewhat of a bubble in New York, New Jersey, and the coast. And I was in the South and just listening to these kids. I mean, they were in such pain. They sort of accepted all of this shame. They accepted all of this, crap that they had been given. And they had basic two alternatives. Either get, you know, sort of nail the closet shut and sort of distort and contort and live this like vicious, cruel existence, or be who they are, but not be embraced. And what was wonderful is there's a great, you know, vibrant LGBT community there. So, I mean, I was trying to literally make sure that young people had somebody to talk to. But I see that around the country. I mean, every place isn't like Denver. I was in Texas a couple days ago, and I've got a lot of good friends. I mean, obviously, you make friends over 25 years, and they're your friends. I mean, there's a whole group of people, you know, that in politics... you know, whether you're Joseph Lieberman, who's, you know, ran against the Democratic Party. I mean, politics is a very fickle business. I mean, it's sort of by nature, I'm reminded of Beckett, but I mean, just, it's very fickle. But I mean, you've got good friends that you're really there. And obviously I support the party, but one of my personal frustrations, I like to see the party be more aggressive on LGBT issues. I mean, you look to Spain and you look even to Ireland and you look to Canada. There was one party who supported us and one party who opposed us. And we've got the Democratic Party. I mean, Eliot Spitzer, who's running for governor of New Jersey, came out at the Empire Pride and said, you know, he's for gay marriage. And that was wonderful. But you look at the Democratic Party, I mean, the national platform or state platform, and it's frustrating. And, you know, you go for, I went from sort of being the top of the heap in the sense of being perceived as a straight, white, Irish Catholic, male governor, and then all of a sudden you come out and you're the same human being, and, you know, I can't marry, and what are my rights, and what are my rights, and my partner's rights vis-a-vis my daughter, and if I had been married to a woman, what would those, I mean, it's just, and all of a sudden it just becomes so apparent. But I'm optimistic because so much has been done in the last 20 years. But I think it's really important on the question of gay marriage. And I know there's sort of, you know, different gay rights organizations have different strategies of what ought to be a priority. But some of the people that I really respect talk about this in terms of, you know, whether it's now or a year from now or a decade from now or 2 decades from now, but they see it as being critically important because it goes to the heart of where society places our value. And if somehow we're less than marriage, then we're less than or not as good as. And if you look at every historical civil rights battle in the United States, ultimately it's about equality. And language does count. We're not saying that a particular faith tradition has to affirm gay marriage, but we're saying the state, the government, has to afford it as a matter of right. And so it's, you know, I some of my old friends, I mean, obviously I go them once in a while, but those friendships remain.
Relationship about women?
I had a troubled political relationship and a good personal relationship with her. I mean, I disagreed with her on environmental policy, and she was great as governor, and then she was okay as governor, but then when she went to EPA, it was just like the Governor Whitman, I mean, she was following the Bush line. I mean, but she was a new source review on coal-powered plants, and New Jersey, a third, I'd say closer to two-fifths of our airborne pollutants come from Ohio and Pennsylvania coal production. So when they were changing NSR from the Clinton administration regs to the Bush administration regs, I mean, that's toxic. I mean, that our kids are breathing. And she took a real tough position, ironically, with the Clinton administration, to her credit. And then she sort of flipped, and so we had some skirmishes. But when I was running against her in 97, she refused to allow the gay rumors to be used by the Republican State Committee. So I had great respect for her personally. I mean, I think she's a good human being. And the Democrats would go nuts when I said that. I said, you could disagree with somebody and still respect them. So I admire her personally. Yes. I think it's great for the next generation. I was with a group of kids at University of Pennsylvania, and I try to go to old college campuses. And this next generation who's just say, I'm gay, next issue. And they do it so well. In the meantime, you know, my generation with sackcloth and ash, tortured, and we're getting married, and we're destroying other people's lives, and we're like, it's like old Mishigash. And so, you know, that what's great about the young people, I mean, I've met this group of great women and men, I keep calling them kids, but I mean, they're young people, and they're just like, I'm gay, next. And we're just like, wow. And it's just so healthy because it's open, it's public, and their whole generation is so much better on our issues. So I think, you know, the world belongs to them. But, you know, I do want to help, you know, the LGBT community. I do want to help in terms of children's advocacy. And I think that's what I want to do. And, you know, there are a lot of good programs. I mean, my friend Kevin Jennings with GLSEN, the Trevor Project. I mean, teenage gay suicide is 3 times higher than the straight suicide rate. And it's just, again, once you walk out of this bubble, it's demonstrable. It's tangible out there. So I think that's where I want to focus. So that, you know, kids 15 to 23 make the right decision as opposed to the decision I made. Thank you. Sure. I think she did get it at the end of it. I thought Oprah, I thought Matt Lauer, and I thought Larry King. And it's interesting. I think they all got it in their own way. And Larry King is great because he's just like this, he's like your grandfather from Miami. And, you know, and he was just wonderful. He's just sitting there and I'm like talking to him before the show. And he said, you know, he had gay people on in the 70s in Miami. And people were like calling him, what are you doing, raving lunatic? And he's like, you know, Larry's like, so he likes boys instead of girls. I mean, Larry's like, you know, and Larry's like, but I mean, Larry, I mean, he's, you know, for his generation, that's damn impressive. I mean, his point is live and let live. And Oprah is her whole crew, and she's got a very, I mean, she is actually the woman who came to our home, you know, in the middle of the interview, she said, you know, by the way, I want you to know I'm gay and da-da-da. But they're there to do a job. And their job is not necessarily the LGBT audience, but their job is straight America and, in Oprah's case, a majority of straight women in America. And so at the end of it, I felt good because those are the questions that's on their mind. And so when somebody gives me like a hard ass, you know, like Sean Hannity, I mean, Sean is like, I went to the lines then because I did not want to go into any, you know, sort of what I affectionately refer to as sort of conservative, you know, red baiting. But I felt Oprah asked the questions that were on the mind of her audience. And so it's good to be out there. And the same time is, you know, I've gone to LGBT interviews and And I did something, and Mark happened to be there. We was in New York. And it was a group of women and men, my generation, who were all out. And they, not all of them, I'd say about a third, couldn't get it why I was still in the closet. I mean, because, like, they had done it to their credit. But then it's so funny because then after the book signing, people come up to me and said, oh, I just came out a year ago, my wife, and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, where were you when they were asking me those questions? Like, you know, but it's sort of, and it's interesting. I mean, people bring their own experience to it. But what I have found is the interviews that are the most honest and direct, and as long as I'm, you know, I said, whether it's to that audience with my friend Fred Hochberg by NYU, I said, like, I wouldn't have come out. And they didn't get that. Like, well, why not? But you just have to, as long as you're truthful to your experience, people eventually will get it.
Right.
And my point is, the closet's a sick place. And let's not make the next generation of American kids, you know, we tell them to be honest, and George Washington chopped down the cherry tree, and I said I did. And then I was with a group of kids in Washington, D.C., lobbying on an anti-bullying bill, and this girl tells me how she comes out and she's honest, and she gets kicked down a flight of stairs, and her teacher doesn't do a damn thing. And she's telling this to a United States senator, who gets it, by the way, who got it. But it's, you know, but we still don't have a federal anti-bullying bill. So, I mean, the need is to speak, to ask the tough questions, to put them on the table, and then hopefully make people have the courage to do the right thing. Yeah. Yeah. I would have never had the courage to come out. I mean, I think something would have careened off course, and you would have had a major course correction because of acting out in a stupid way. But would have I intentionally sat down and said, well, next Thursday I'm going to come out because my life is miserable, I'm depressed, and whatever. Bless you. I wish I could think that it would happen. I don't see, I mean, maybe if life became so unbearable, so crushing. But there were points that I was incredibly, you know, moribund. But I don't see myself at least getting there in the short term, no. Yeah. Yeah, it was. I mean, my old Irish grandmother says, God works in mysterious ways. And I think it was my father said, he's been very mysterious. Sure. Well, I don't think that was my expression, but I mean, that was Larry. No, but I think it's a remarkable, I mean, for his generation, that's real significant movement. Larry King has got to be 70 plus. And, you know, I know people 40 plus don't think that. So I guess I was just trying to inartfully give praise to him. No, I mean, what you hope is for an American society that embraces the concept of love between two individuals and an open monogamous committed and gives us the full rights and privileges. But I also still think that gay bashing is the last acceptable discrimination in America. And I think it's okay to put on the ballot, i.e., you know, Colorado, to have an anti-gay marriage. I mean, if you did that for any other defined minority in America, it just wouldn't happen. And so it's just amazing. Now, at the same time, look what's happened. I was with, I stopped by the Denver LGBT Center on 1050 Broadway, and Lisa and I dragged her, because I always try to go down and see the kids, and it's a great center, and I talked to the director there, Judy. No, Deborah is the director of outreach. Judy Calhoun was great. And Judy was telling me that, you know, she went to I think it was Swarthmore, and she came out years ago, and she said, I would have thought that years later people were going to be debating the idea of gay marriage, and there was actually a state in America and Canada that had gay marriage. I never thought it would possible. So I also want to be really optimistic, because America's moving, and I think culturally, America is going to get there far before the political class. I mean, that, you know, you things as, you know, even Will and Grace in the popular culture. You see in the books, you see popular attitudes among people, you know, between 18 to 25. Their perspective on gay marriage and gay rights is entirely different than my generation. So I think there's a sea change. The problem is right now there's a major political party using the question of gay rights as a means of mobilizing their base. Not swinging independent voters, mobilizing their base, which becomes, you know, hateful and destructive and bound in shame. So it'll happen, sure. I know Pleasantville. No, it's a great town. And they've got this whole revitalization in the Little Harbor. And... Sure. Well, two things that are a concern. One is the United States Supreme Court. And you look at every major civil rights movement in this country, and the courts were out front first, and then the legislature followed. And even if the courts were out only insofar as they protected the right to protest, Dr. King, Selma, you look at some of the court decisions prior to the 64 Civil Rights Act, and it was the Warren Court that led the way. And you look to our state or U.S. Supreme Court right now, and with Justice Roberts and Alito, and that's not going to happen. And then concurrent to that, you have 18 states passing anti-gay referendum. And you have a really interesting dynamic because you have the popular class and the next generation moving so rapidly, arguably even more rapidly than the civil rights movement has applied to women or African Americans because of the omnipresence of the popular media. But at the same time, you have this very restrictive court that's not going to expand questions of marriage and questions of equal access, and you have all these state referendum. So I think ultimately, when that generation is in charge, there'll be a sea change. And the sea change will happen when all of a sudden, you know, when the tipping point happens, it's just all going to go. And it's going to go quickly because that generation has just a completely different mindset. Do I think it's going to go gradually now? Probably not. I mean, I think we've got, the court is the court. I mean, these are lifetime tenure positions. So we're not going to have a Supreme Court, even if we have a Democratic, God willing, presidency in 08. I mean, you're not going to have a majority on the court, even if you had, which isn't likely, to have Democratic candidates to the bench that would support gay marriage. So I think it just has to reach that threshold, and then I think you'll see a wave happen that will just knock down what is, you know, systemic discrimination, where there is gay marriage. Sure, I do, Gabe. I think the closet is, it's defining, but for me, and I can only speak to myself and only judge my actions, I think it is a sick-making place, because what happens is you accept the premise, I think wrongly, that being gay is less than, is somehow wrong, and so you take that shame, and then because you can't think that you can be open and public and be gay, all of a sudden, for me, I started acting out in inappropriate ways, in unhealthy, shameful ways, which only corroborated the initial shame. And so, ironically, because you accept the premise and you accept that set of rules, it becomes a self-condemnatory policy. Now, if I wasn't in the closet and somebody and I had had the courage to go to my parents or whomever and someone said, you're unconditionally loved, and if you're gay or straight, it makes no difference to us, I think I would have led a very different, more healthy, balanced, not only sexual, but also relational existence. And I also wouldn't have, sort of mired other people in my own crazy-making, which, you know, I impacted other people's lives. And I need to understand and recognize and make amends for that. And so I saw a great German movie, 2 weeks ago, about a kid who heads a crew team, and he's representing a straight fruit. Do you know the movie? It was all in German, but I mean, I read the subtitles. I took 6 years of German and showed you what that did for me. I'm like, what do the subtitles say? Every once in a while, I could get a verb after 20 minutes. And this kid, he's competing against a gay crew team. Is that the movie? Summer Storm, and by the end of the weekend, he comes out, and it's just sort of like, you know, that's healthy to do it in a weekend. I did it over, 25 years. It's not good. I'm getting the axe here. Is there any last question? The gentleman in the back? No, we talked about it a little bit. No, I think what I want to do is I want to really work with kids to make sure they make the right decisions in their life. And it's about the truth, transparency, you know, living their passion, living their truth, but also trying to work to make sure America is accepting of that truth. And that's with anti-bullying legislation and particularly for kids, sort of battling that fear and battling what I perceive as, in certain cases, religious-based discrimination that estranges kids not only from their God, but from themselves, which is, I'll leave you with this thought. This old Benedictine priest said to me, religion is what man does to God, which I thought was an interesting thought. And so it's understanding the importance of spirituality in our lives. And even with these kids in Atlanta, once they came out, my message to them was, you don't have to give up your spirituality. It's not like being gay or being spiritual. I mean, if you look back through history, gays were, in many cultures, the shamans. They were the storytellers. They were the ones who understood or tried to narrate the sense of spirit in community. And so, but it's not accepting the premise of what other people put on us, either in terms of shame or the divisiveness. So I think hopefully I'll make a contribution there. Well, you've been very kind, and thank you very much for attendance, and I'll be up here, and thank you for all that you've done in your lives for LGBT rights and also helping the next generation feel proud and honored to be who they are. Thanks so much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Sina Jeter-Naslin, T.A. Barron, Barack Obama, Richard Ford, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on October 9th, 2006.